Welcome. It's another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Paff joined by Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, new research could yield a new treatment option for those afflicted with thyroid cancer. A Roman soldier's gold bracelet is discovered, and likely not in the manner you'd expect. And on this day in history, milk is sold in glass bottles for the first time. That's all coming up on Cool Stuff. Well, another promising story from the medical world, as a new study suggests many patients with thyroid cancer could avoid surgery in favor of a new, minimally invasive procedure known as microwave ablation. Simply put, the approach uses heat from microwave energy to destroy cancer cells. In turn, of course, patients avoid having to undergo an operation, which I think everyone would agree is always preferred if possible. Now, per GNN, researchers at the China-Japan Friendship Hospital in Beijing developed this new application using microwave ablation. Ablation, by the way, is defined by Mayo Clinic as a minimally invasive procedure doctors use to destroy abnormal tissue and can be executed via probes inserted through the skin, flexible tubes inserted through an artery, think of catheters there, or energy beams, the last of which is obviously at work here. The new research marks the first analysis of patients who used the new procedure compared with those who underwent surgery for papillary thyroid cancer. So to be clear here, a number of individuals have now tried microwave ablation in lieu of surgery, but this new research was the first in-depth comparison of the two options, and what they found was extremely encouraging. Per Dr. Ming-An Yu, director of interventional medicine at the Friendship Hospital, quote, "These findings challenge traditional treatment paradigms and open new avenues for less invasive management strategies," end quote. While thyroid surgery can be life-saving, it can also, unfortunately, produce some long-term negative effects on the patient's quality of life. Consider factors like scarring, lifelong hormone replacement, and potential complications such as permanent hoarseness of the voice. Alternatively, microwave ablation rarely produces any serious side effects. The latest study was published in the journal Radiology and examined 775 patients with stage 1 PTC, that's papillary thyroid cancer, each of whom was treated using either microwave ablation or surgery at 10 different locations between 2015 and December of 2021. Each patient had two or more lumps on their thyroid gland at the time of treatment, with 229 of them using the ablation approach and 453 opting for surgery. The patients were followed up with for between 1 and 4 years. Now for the results. Microwave ablation was associated with similar progression-free survival rates to surgery, but with fewer complications and a greater potential for preserving thyroid function. All good things, of course. The microwave heat treatment resulted in less blood loss, shorter incision length, with shorter procedure and hospitalization durations. Permanent hoarseness and hypothyroidism were encountered only in the surgical resection group. Per Dr. Yu, quote, "This preliminary investigation represents a significant advancement in the field of interventional thyroid cancer treatment. Microwave ablation offers a promising treatment option and can preserve thyroid function, thereby enhancing patients' quality of life," end quote.
I love hearing these stories that we just keep getting more and more of ways to prevent or cure, I don't know if cure is the right word, but cancer, like get rid of cancer. It seems like every day there's a new story on different approaches against cancer, and it's great to hear.
Yeah, I agree, Reggie. It's always fun for you and I, having a chance to do this podcast, to stay on top of the latest in medical research and what we're on the precipice of. But if I had to think about this from the perspective of the general population, and this is not a knock on anyone involved, I just think it's a matter of fact. The most frustrating part of all this is that you heard me reference the date ranges there for how long they've been working on or exploring these two alternative options to treatment. And it dates back to 2015. So we're already at year 9 of this being tested in some form or fashion. And I suspect, based on what we're reading here, that this is still not close to being rolled out to the general population as a treatment option. And maybe I'm wrong about that, and perhaps I shouldn't speculate, but generally speaking, when we encounter stories from the medical world, that's the toughest part, because clearly you have to go through the proper protocols, the proper testing. You want to make sure that it's safe to roll out. And I understand all of that. All of that is absolutely necessary. It's not something that should be skipped. I'm not advocating for them to change their ways. I'm just saying that from the time we first hear about some promising new treatment, it often takes a long time, a lot of years, a decade plus in many instances, before it's actually ready to be used on the general population.
And for good reason. I mean,
yes, and I'm saying that, and yeah, I want to be clear about that. I think I tried to make that clear. Yes, for good reason. However, it's hard not to be frustrated when you're still talking about, God, that looks so great, and it could be represent such a leap forward, and yet, okay, maybe in 15 years from now we'll do it.
Yes, but when you have people 40 years down the line, they look back at it, be like, hey, just think how bad it was, you know, 50 years ago, and now we have it so good. I mean, it takes a lot of time in the immediate, but if you look at it towards the future, it is all necessary. Obviously, you need to get everything right, and it doesn't, I don't know. I'm trying to explain how I'm trying to think that in my head, but think of things that were like polio. You know, we had a huge, you know, creating the vaccine and how long that took. And nowadays, you don't really think about it as much.
Well, yeah, because we don't have polio. So clearly we don't think about it as much. But the people that needed it at the time when polio was ravaging the country certainly thought about it.
Exactly. And we're kind of in that case now with, you know, cancer. We need this, but how many years down the road will it just be kind of a secondary thought of like, oh yeah, cancer. Well, you can go and get treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. I hope that's the case someday. You know what? If I'd love to think that it's some sort of over the counter treatment sometime down the road, but you know, we've got a ways to go, but hey, kudos to all the medical community out there who is making these progressions or making these steps forward possible for everyone. Well, speaking for myself, it was always fun to head off into the woods or a nearby field in search of treasure. Back when I was a kid, of course, here. And I'm using the term treasure lightly, actually holding up air quotes here, but occasionally you'd stumble upon something that was pretty darn cool, like maybe a Native American arrowhead. But 12-year-old Rowan Brannan of the UK was not actively looking for treasure. It found him while he and his mom were out walking their dog, and the value of his find could be up there with any jewel that might be pulled from a sunken chest. Brannan plucked an item from the dirt that his mom initially assumed was nothing more than strapping used for packaging or fencing. But upon closer inspection, it was determined to be a gold bracelet belonging to a Roman soldier dating all the way back to the year 1 AD. The year 1 AD. Said Rowan's mom, Amanda, quote, "Rowan has always been into finding all sorts of bits and pieces. I'm forever saying, put it down, it's dirty. But on this occasion, he kept holding this bit of metal, convinced that it was actual real gold. I thought it was just some strapping from a fence or something. It was very dirty," end quote. So here's how the revelation that this piece was actually of value came about. Rowan took the bracelet home and conducted research to try and determine whether it was real gold. It met all the criteria on the checklist he found, but the real epiphany didn't occur until a hairdresser, of all people, visited their home. Per Yahoo UK, the hairdresser told Rowan and his mom that she enjoyed metal detecting, so they showed her the bracelet. The hairdresser then took a photo of the piece and later showed it to the leader of her metal detecting session, who recommend they contact the fines officer at their local council. The officer now sends frequent updates to Rowan about the piece he found almost 2 years ago. Yeah, so this dates back a little ways to when he actually found this piece. Amanda Brannan told Yahoo, quote, "It's been rumbling on for a really long time. The fines liaison officer was very interested in the gold, so we had to go up to Horsham to drop it off because it's then property of the Crown while it's going through all these different processes," end quote. She also noted that the piece has been analyzed at the British Museum and gone through the coroner's court in a fascinating process where she and Rowan have been learning more and more about the piece. By the way, in England, an official responsible for safeguarding the private property of the Crown, which is what the bracelet in fact becomes here, that's what a coroner is. So not thinking about someone who's actually investigating the circumstances of a suspicious death. Just want to be clear about that. The gold Rowan found was a portion of an Armilla bracelet. The corresponding armbands were awarded as a military decoration to Roman soldiers as a symbol of respect for valor and service. Now, you might be wondering, will Rowan and his family benefit financially from this discovery? And the answer is not necessarily. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you may recall the story we did a few weeks back that also laid out British law surrounding the discovery of historic artifacts. The government's definition of treasure factors in prominently here, but it's not necessarily easy for the average individual to recognize whether certain pieces meet the government's criteria. It goes something like this. Anyone who finds an item of historic interest must contact their local fines liaison officer or risk criminal prosecution. The gov.uk website states that a finder must report treasure to the local coroner within either 14 days of first finding it or 14 days of realizing an item might be treasure, even if they've had it for longer. An individual only needs to report items officially defined as treasure, which include coins and items thought to be precious metals, such as silver or gold, provided they are, this is of course a key criterion here, more than 300 years old. Key element of time in this law, 300 years. Not sure why they said it there, but that's the number. There's an unlimited fine or up to 3 months prison sentence for not reporting treasure. The finder will be contacted by either a local fines liaison officer or museum curator, who will then write a report on said find. Museums can express an interest in it if it might be treasure. After an inquest, the item may be shared with a museum, returned to its original owner, or handed back to the finder. So if you stumble upon something that looks pretty neat and pretty old in the UK, you're supposed to turn it over and let the government decide what to do with it, because, as mentioned, it becomes property of the crown, which is still interesting to say in the year 2024, property of the crown. It strikes me as something that was thought of or said hundreds of years ago, which it was, but still something that's referenced in specific situations in the UK.
Honestly, this British law makes it so if I found treasure, I would probably be like, nope, I'm leaving that here. I don't want to deal with any hassles that have to do with this. Just go my way and let somebody else find it. Because then you're going to have to go through all these processes and talk to people. If you're not getting anything out of it, it doesn't seem worth it.
Well, in previous stories that we've had that dealt with this same type of law, and recall we had a magnet fishing story in which a Viking sword was found a few weeks back, there was the possibility of a reward of some kind being handed out to the person who discovered it, but it's not a guarantee. And so, yeah, I guess it kind of comes down to, is it worth the story? Hey, I found this Viking sword, and I get regular updates and they tell me what they've found out about it or what they're possibly able to find out about it now, thousands of years later. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I could see where it would be a little bit of a deterrent, because you're going, God, I don't want to get mixed up with the law and all this simply because I didn't report something properly. And I don't know, you know, my guess would be, and this is me having no knowledge of this, that it's really to prevent high-end criminals from, I don't know, making a discovery, a massive find of some kind, and then just selling it on the international market as opposed to bringing it into a museum. Whereas, you know, a young guy like Rowan here finds a bracelet, I would hope that they're not going to be ultra rigid in their enforcement of these laws, even though in this case, he clearly abided by what he was supposed to be doing by law.
And I want to know what Rowan was doing for research when he found this. You said he brought it home, did some research on it. What was he doing? I mean, he's what, 12, you said?
I would guess surf the web. That's my, you know, hey, what could this possibly be? Google image search?
At 12 years old, I'm not doing research on what I just found in the yard. I don't know. That's just me.
Well, you never found a gold bracelet, so.
Very true. But I found a lot of bottle caps and nails. I mean,
I don't think the British law requires you turn over your Coke bottle cap or your rusty nail, for that matter.
Excuse me, museum. I found this rusty nail. Do you want it? Taking a look at this day in history on April 8th, 1879, milk was sold in glass bottles for the first time. Prior to this, when customers bought milk, they would bring in a keg or a bucket or whatever they had, and the seller would just fill that. Now, I'm not so sure how I feel about the cleanliness of that, but then again, it was 1800s. You probably didn't worry about cleanliness as much. Some dairies would try to use fruit jars after some people brought them in so they could be sealed. However, it was Echo Farms Dairy in New York City that created the first bottle made specifically for milk. Their milk was delivered from Litchfield, Connecticut. Some dealers weren't originally a fan of the bottles, as at first they worried they would break, and some customers thought the bottles had a drugstore look, and they weren't a fan of them either. However, the new bottles eventually caught on, and at the start of the 1900s, several cities required that milk be delivered in those glass bottles. childhood diseases and deaths decreased after 1879 for a variety of reasons. It is believed, though, that the sanitary delivery of milk was a contributing factor. Now that kids had clean milk to drink, as the bottles had better sanitation and lower bacterial count, thousands of kids were able to live healthy life and grow to adulthood. The bottles, however, did make their rounds as people would return them when going back to the store or when the milkman came around for a delivery. In the early 1900s, on average, the bottle would make 22 and a half round trips before it was broken, stolen, or people would keep them for other uses. The lost bottles were only part of the reasons that people stopped using glass bottles. It was also costly to return them to the bottling plant where they needed to be washed and then sterilized. Plus, there were concerns about transporting the bottles when you had new clean milk next to the unsanitary used bottles. Around 1890s, there were some wax containers that were used for milk. Their shapes varied from simple boxes, cylinders, cones, truncated pyramids, and some that resembled that glass bottle. By the 1940s, the rectangular column design that had a small round pull-up cap and a flat top piece took over as the preferred container. They had the advantage of being lightweight and used little space in the trucks. Plus, you know, they were disposable.
Okay. Why? I guess I'm not certain as to what the cost would be, but it feels like reusing glass bottles wouldn't be that difficult from a sanitation standpoint. Although, in thinking about this as I speak, this was a long time ago, so you didn't necessarily have an industrial method of cleaning like, hey, we've got this massive dishwasher that we can throw all these bottles in and clean them with one full swoop, as opposed to, you know, I don't know. I'm guessing they weren't hand washing, but probably not as efficient as it would be today.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a time process too. You know, you had to collect the bottles. I mean, you took up room in the truck for the used bottles. You had to make sure you had room for that. So you collected them, you brought them back. There was, you know, gas, or not, maybe not gas in the 1890s, but, you know, the delivery time to do that, bring it in, you have to wash them, you have to make sure they're sanitary. And then along that process, some of them would get broken, which means then you have to buy new bottles. So, and, you know, I'm sure buying a bunch of glass bottles wasn't cheap either.
Yeah, I guess I need to consider the time frame we're talking about when thinking of this, because in my mind, I'm going, how difficult is it to partition your truck out to one side for used, the other side for new glass milk bottles that are being delivered so that you don't cross-contaminate anything by placing them right next to each other. However, at that time, probably a little bit more difficult task, a bit more costly task than it would be today when we're just accustomed to seeing things like this all the time from large manufacturers of food and drink.
Yeah, it still seems weird to me to have milk delivered to your front door. That just seems odd to me. I can't even imagine it.
It is a little strange, but I will tell you, Reg, I would take that all day because I go through a lot of it. So that would save me a trip once in a while over to the grocery store.
You see, and I don't use a ton of milk, so it just, I don't know. I like to have my disposable container. I just go to the store as I need it. But I don't know. It seems weird to have the whole milkman concept. I mean, just the whole concept seems interesting to me.
Yeah, I guess, you know, not to go down the path too far with this, but milk, kind of a staple of any and everything that you're making or baking at home.
Yeah.
And in that time frame, not everybody's going out to restaurants with regularity to eat dinner or lunch. You're doing a lot of cooking at home, and milk oftentimes is a key ingredient to many of those things. So to have it available to you by delivery, I'm guessing, was a pretty big convenience.
And plus, how would all those rumors get started that you're the milkman's son? I mean, come on.
I mean, I've been sitting here waiting for you to make a joke about that. So now I guess we can end the show.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for joining us on another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Plus, like us, follow us, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Path. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.